Well, good evening and welcome on behalf of both The Economist and our co-hosts for this evening's event, the LSE Centre for the Study of Human Rights. It's a wonderful turnout. We're very glad to have you here, and we're looking forward to your interventions later on in the debate. I have confess to a touch of nervousness, and it's not just because as a former student of the school I'm more used to sitting down there being talked to than sitting up here and doing the talking, but also The Economist until recently wouldn't use the phrase human rights. It was on a little banned list of phrases which our former foreign editor had on the grounds he didn't know what it meant. He said you should say torture, murder, false imprisonment. If you can't think of anything precise, say government beastliness. He also didn't let us use the word civil society, because he didn't know what that meant, and you should say do-gooders and busybodies instead. We've slightly relaxed that, and we do occasionally use the phrase human rights, but we're also very keen on economic development, and you can read a lot about that in The Economist. I'm not going to give a long introduction to our speakers here. I'm just going to make a couple of very basic preliminary announcements, most of which is please turn off your mobile phone. Any infringement of this rule will be punished without regard to your human rights in the form of general contempt from everybody else. Our speakers are going to speak for no more than 8 minutes each, and then after that we'll throw the motion open to you, and you can ask questions to the speakers or make points as you prefer, and then we will have a brief summing up from the speakers, and then we'll have a vote. But to make the vote more meaningful, we're going to have a vote at the beginning as well. This is a very unscientific straw poll, not weighted or even properly measured by independent monitors, just by my sort of rough calculation. So can we first of all just see, hands up, those of you who would agree with the motion and say that respect for human rights is essential for economic development. Hands up who thinks that. Right, and hands up those who disagree with it. Right, well, I'd say it's about 8 or 9 to 1 in favour of the motion. Any abstentions? And we've got 4 open-minded people and 9 to 1 against the in favour of the motion. Therefore, I think His Excellency, the High Commissioner of Ghana, Sir Isaac Ozai, is batting on what we use a cricketing analogy called very good wicket. It's yours to lose, but you have 8 minutes to fire up your audience even more, and perhaps to convince those waivers to change sides as well, Your Excellency. Yes, please, yes.
Well, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I speak for the motion that respect for human rights is essential to economic development. What human rights are we talking about? We are talking about rights which we are born with as human beings, rights which are universal. First, we are talking also about the rights articulated in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. These include political and civil liberties, free speech, press freedom, and entitlement to due process of the law. These are often called the traditional rights. And secondly, we are talking about the rights spelled out in the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. These include the right to basic needs, an adequate standard of living, employment, good health and nutrition and education. These two international covenants reinforce the provisions of the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Let me offer a definition of economic development. As a long-term process of change, positive change which affords people choices and opportunities to sustain or to improve and sustain livelihoods and well-being, that is to assure a better life. First, the process of economic development requires a functioning state, with a government exercising political and administrative authority, a government generally recognized by the broad mass of the people as representative. Thus, respect for the right of the people to choose those who govern them is essential to assure support for governance structures and public policy. And public policy must be informed by public debate, either in the press or in the parliament or assembly. Political and civil liberties are essential to good governance, which underpins the economic development process. Good governance is not only participatory, but has transparency and accountability as its pillars. Thus, good governance enables consensual decisions affecting the development process to be made. failed states with unrepresentative central authorities cannot assure the peace and stability which good governance assures. Mr. Chairman, it goes without saying that political participation and democratic governance play critical roles in sustainable development. Mr. Chairman, good governance also assures an entitlement to due process of law, which is a basic right which enables citizens to seek justice, offenders to be punished, and disputes settled. This is essential for the process of economic development. Economic development, its focus, its object is the people. That is why economic development in practically every country in the world has concentrated on investing in education, that is building schools, training teachers, and a whole range of professionals, technicians, and labor to drive the process of development, the building of hospitals and clinics, and the training of doctors, nurses, pharmacists, paramedics, are critical to ensure a healthy population and prevent unnecessary loss of life. Investment in infrastructure, such as roads and highways, ports and harbors, and energy, is important in the development process not only to facilitate trade in assuring the easy movement of goods and the mobility of the population, but also as a means for social interaction. Access to these socioeconomic facilities to the broad masses of the people empowers them with the capacity to function and contribute to the economic development process. A clear and unambiguous recognition of their citizens' economic and social cultural rights is thus clearly essential to economic development. Mr. Chairman, as High Commissioner for Ghana, it is only proper that I use my own country as an example. The economic history of my own country, Ghana, shows that our first government after independence invested heavily in education, health, and social infrastructure, in people, at a time when there was competition for political power in a multi-party system. Ghana was booming. Industries were set up to produce a whole range of goods for local consumption and export, using a healthy and fairly well-educated workforce. Ghana, from 1957 to about 1962, was growing rapidly and had indeed become the black shining star of Africa. But as the Nkrumah government tightened its grip on power and avenues for accommodating different views were stifled, violent incidents against government were recorded and opposition figures were detained or forced into exile. Ghana subsequently became a one-party state. Investments in Ghana began to fall off, and by 1966, Ghana's economy was on the brink of collapse. The government was overthrown in a military coup. Ghana remained more or less unstable with alternate changes of government from military to civilian, with long periods of dictatorship and denial of rights. This period until 1992 did not see any significant development. In 1992, Ghana returned to multi-party democracy, and full political, economic, social, and cultural rights were restored. Between 1992 and 2000, the economy of Ghana grew at an average of 4.5%. If you compare that to the 1% that it grew in the previous 12 or 13 years, you know what I'm talking about. But in 2000, for the first time in the history of Ghana, power passed from one political party to another after a general election. Over the last 5 years, the deepening of the democratic process has led to a vibrant parliament and a free and independent press. Good governance is now at the heart of government, and the economic development process has made substantial progress. No Ghanaian has to be told that an accountable government, which is committed to respecting the political, civil, economic, social, and cultural rights of its people, underpinned by the rule of law, is a sine qua non for economic development. Every Ghanaian knows that the best period for economic development in Ghana were those early years of Nkrumah and the last 5 years under the current president, President Kufuor. These years also marked the periods when respect for human rights were recognized and enhanced. Mr. Chairman, the paradigm for development in our world today emphasizes poverty reduction strategies, which also target the vulnerable and underprivileged as the surest way of mainstreaming the people into the development process. The major international development institutions, such as the UNDP, the World Bank, the African Development Bank, have recognized the complementarity and interdependence of human rights and development. In Ghana, our own poverty reduction strategy has led to substantial investment in education and health and rural infrastructure, such as feeder roads, water schemes, electricity provision. Indeed, Ghana is implementing a free, compulsory, universal basic education. And from next year, every primary school child will be given 1 meal a day. the policies are beginning to show results as enrollment rates rise and the numbers of female children in school continually increase. Mr. Chairman, the African Union has formulated its new Partnership for Africa's Development as its blueprint for development. NEPAD emphasizes a holistic and multidimensional approach to development and recognizes the mutual dependency of economic development and social, economic, cultural, political, and civil rights. Through the African peer review mechanism under NEPAD, compliance and conformity with internationally accepted standards for good governance, accountability, and respect for human rights are required. Ghana and Rwanda have already offered themselves as initial candidates for the APRM, and interim reports have already been issued, enabling the two countries to improve on areas where they have not met the standards. The African Development Bank, the G8 countries, the European Union have all pledged their support for the African peer review mechanism. Mr. Chairman, every country on the globe signed up to the Millennium Development Goals in 2000 and affirmed the principles underpinning these goals in the recent World Summit in New York. The 8 broad goals show that the world recognizes that respect for human rights is essential to economic development. For the avoidance of doubt, let me state broadly what these goals are. We know the target 2015, but let me state broadly. 1, eradicate extreme poverty and hunger. 2, achieve universal primary education. 3, promote gender equality and empower women. 4, reduce child mortality. 5, improve maternal health. 6, combat HIV, AIDS, malaria, TB, and other diseases. 7, ensure environmental sustainability. And 8, develop a global partnership for development. Mr. Chairman, may I rest my case?
You certainly may. Well, thank you very much, not least for keeping so strictly to the time limit. And I should also say there are going to be some drinks after our event tonight, and if you stay to the end, I'll tell you where they are. My pleasure to turn to Alex Singleton, the director of the Globalization Institute, a fluent defender of free market economics in the case of globalization, who's going to have the hard job of arguing against motherhood and apple pie. Alex.
Thank you. The debate being on this side is rather difficult. The downside of being here rather than over there is that people in the audience are likely to assume that you're not actually in favor of human rights. And yet, human rights are very central to my position. I, after all, want to live in a world in which people are free to make choices about their lives, free to vote for their government to kick them out, free to criticize their governments, free to get a fair trial by a jury, free to practice whatever religion they want to. And the debate's complicated because all manner of things are put under the label, the banner of human rights. If you call an international minimum wage a human right, well, I find that very difficult to support. It would, after all, discourage companies from investing in poor countries. It would reduce competition for labor in poor countries, and it would depress living standards for the world's poorest. So I wouldn't be in favor of that if you call this a human right. At the same time, I want to see the things that we've heard in the Millennium Development Goals. I want to see more investment in developing countries, better wealth and prosperity, better healthcare in the world. But in terms of human rights, I like to view human rights in the same way as the 19th century liberals like John Stuart Mill. I think this is also how most ordinary people view human rights. They don't view human rights as a right to a certain amount of money or so forth. But if you go to Joe Bloggs on the street, I think that if you ask them what human rights were, they'd say things like torture and prevention from being tortured and those sorts of things. And for liberals like Mill, rights talked about things we should be free from. We should be free from being hit, free from having our speech prevented, free from persecution. And rights to them were not about entitlements, such as the right to healthcare paid for by others. Such entitlements, however, may well be consequences of economic development, just as human rights themselves are. After all, even America provides Medicaid and Medicare for its poor and elderly. So my argument tonight is that human rights are a consequence of economic development rather than prerequisites to economic development. And to make my point, I have three parts to my argument. The first is that putting the horse before the cart is a good idea, and putting the cart before the horse is counterproductive. If you try and make countries do human rights before development, you get neither development nor human rights. The second point is that there are prerequisites to development. They aren't human rights. They are instead free markets and openness to trade and things like that. And my final point is that economic freedom is a force that attacks social authoritarianism and secures those human rights that we're so desperate to have. So let's start with my first point, that putting the cart before the horse is counterproductive. If you try and make countries do human rights before development, you actually often set both of those things back. Between 1914 and 1990, there were economic sanctions imposed in 116 cases by various countries. They totally failed to achieve their stated objectives in 66% of those cases, and were at best only partially successful in most of the rest. Since 1973, the success ratio for economic sanctions has fallen to about 24%. In 1962, the United States imposed sanctions against Cuba, and 43 years later, Fidel Castro is still in power. Freedom of expression and association is still restricted, and Castro gets to blame all of his country's woes and poverty on the Americans. American sanctions have reduced investment into Cuba, hindering living standards there. But of course, Cuba has trading relationships with the rest of the world. So in fact, after all the hassle of American sanctions for the Americans, they've actually been a rather weak form of sanction. Yet multilateral UN sanctions have fared little better. Sanctions against Iraq are widely criticized for causing hundreds of thousands of deaths of children. Were they worth it? Well, they didn't bring forth democracy. They didn't get Saddam Hussein's cooperation with weapons inspectors, and they didn't cause Saddam very much suffering, if any at all. They solely hurt the ordinary people. Economic embargoes, said the late John Paul II, are always deplorable because they hurt the most needy. So when people say we should boycott Burma in order to get rid of the dictatorship, or China in order to free Tibet, we do actually have to ask how exactly making ordinary people worse off is going to help. But of course, there are prerequisites to development. It used to be considered that poor countries needed just an injection of cash to kickstart them. That's a view, sadly, still promoted by Gordon Brown, but it looks increasingly shaky. After all, between 1960 and 1997, sub-Saharan Africa received the equivalent of six Marshall Plans of foreign aid, and yet is still poor. Aid, of course, has a part to play, but it's not a prerequisite to development. The countries that have got rich are those which have adopted a good degree of economic liberalism. They're the ones that have opened themselves to trade and adopted market economies. Perhaps the classic example is Hong Kong. In 1960, per capita income, per person income, was 28% of the United Kingdom. And now, well, by 1996, it had risen to 136%, 137% even, of Britain. So the average person in Hong Kong is richer than us after it pursued a more aggressive free market policy than we did. And India, of course, protected its economy for 30 years. Then it adopts a free market, like China is doing now. And its liberalization, China's liberalization policy over the past decade, largest the world's ever seen. And it's lifted 200 million people out of poverty. And if I might just disagree with the High Commissioner, 1992 is not the year of most significance for Ghana. That was the year where democracy came, yes. But the actual fundamental change happened in 1983, when the country started taking World Bank advice, started liberalizing its economy. And whereas the economy had been violently fluctuating for many years before, from that point onwards, from 1983 onwards, it's had uninterrupted economic growth. And if there is a relationship between sort of human rights and economic development, it's the economic development that happened first, and then the democracy that came later. People, of course, have concerns about human rights in China. organisations, brilliant organisations like Doctors Without Borders, have an important part to play in encouraging rights. But thanks to wealth creation in China, there are now 50,000 Chinese students, perhaps at British universities, many probably at the LSE, experiencing a free society and unrestricted access to the internet. Many of those students will go back to China with the idea, the knowledge that you can have a society that both has free expression and doesn't have chaos. Which brings me to my final point, which is really my conclusion, that economic freedom is a force attacking social authoritarianism and human rights violation. The ability to cut off your country from the attitudes and opinions of the rest of the world is easy when you follow autarky. But economic liberalization is a subversive force. It's no surprise that in the 20th century, the countries that treated homosexuals, for example, the worst, were the most economically authoritarian. The Soviet Union put them in concentration camps, while countries with a good deal of economic liberalization, liberalism, liberalized also their social attitudes and policies. So I'd say there's no conflict between human rights and economic development. But I would say that respect for human rights is not essential for development. It is a consequence of development, rather. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Alex. I'm now going to turn to Phil Bloomer, who is the new Campaigns and Policy Director for the charity Oxfam, which promotes both human rights and economic development. But you're going to tell us which is more important, or at least which comes first.
No, I'm not going to tell you which comes first, because both are essential to each other. But it's always good to follow a contribution to the debate which is full of red herrings in terms of the economic... so that's always helpful, thank you. First of all, in terms of talking about economic sanctions and whether they work or not, and then equating that with the debate on respecting rights that are essential to economic development is odd. I've never ever heard anybody saying that minimum wages are a human right, although I have heard many people saying that they're a key facilitating rights to workers being able to claim a fair share of the wealth of their nation through being able to organise. Organising is a fundamental human right. But let's get back to the debate. First of all, is respecting human rights essential to economic development? Well, if we mean that in its narrowest sense, in terms of all rights are essential to any economic development, then I think the answer is easy. It's no, in the sense that if you're expecting me to stand here and say that over the past 150 years, many countries have developed, and yet all and to say that that all those countries have respected all the rights of their people all the time, clearly that's not the case, unfortunately. But so case disproved, motion defeated, we can move to the drinks much earlier. Don't move yet. But that would be a flippant way of using this debate, of course, to use it in such a narrow way. So let's start by unpacking it as we have done. First, the rights are, as my colleague Isaac has said, we mean civil and political freedoms, and we mean economic, social, and cultural rights. What of economic development? Economic development is clearly very different to economic growth. Economic growth means increasing the GDP of an economy, the sheer size of that economy. Economic development means so much more. So much more in terms of you'd have to ask ordinary people, do they have enough to be able to look after their families? Do they have the education and the skills to be able to be a productive part of the workforce? Are they safe and secure enough in their communities? And so willing to invest in the future and their economic development as well as the community around them. If you think I'm just playing with words, if you think economic growth is the same as economic development, then my child of seven, Jack, grew 3 inches last year. Definite growth in height there, and yet it tells you absolutely nothing as to his reading skills or whether he's more capable and willing to share his toys with his younger brother. But the point there is development is fundamentally different to growth. If we fail to recognise that distinction, then we fail to recognise the difference between national accounts and people's livelihoods, people's welfare and people's security. And that's no small mistake to make. So back to the motion. Is respecting human rights essential to economic development? Undoubtedly, yes. And here's why. First of all, respecting civil and political rights is any country's best bet for economic development. If we're talking about the importance of responsive and accountable governments, as Isaac said earlier, if we're talking about the right of people to vote in regular elections, the right to organise freely and to speak out in public, that rights that are here granted to us all, the evidence is overwhelming. People who live in those kind of places are far more likely to be better off than those who live in authoritarian states. It's little surprise that people in Poland are better off than those in Uzbekistan, that those in Uruguay are better off than those in Haiti, that those living in Botswana are far better off than those living in Burundi. Authoritarian states, of course, can have impressive economic records, one of which Alex just referred to. In the 60s and 70s, let's give you another one, the Brazilian economy, under military rule at the time, grew at around 5% a year. That's the miracle, the Brazilian economic miracle. But in fact, it was a miracle for Brazilian elite, not for the Brazilian people. The record, their record, and their memory of that junta was, in fact, of widespread bonded labour, of workers' wages stagnating, and in fact of infant mortality increasing to three times that of Costa Rica, a country with a far smaller economic size and yet also a democracy. So it's no coincidence that democracies tend to come out on top because they harness the eyes, the ears, the brains, the hearts and the voices of their people to make development happen. So if you like to admire, some of you in this audience, the invisible hand of the market, then you have to be surely astonished and marvel at the power of the civil hand of society. And that civil hand of society demands those rights. It's fundamental. Can only be achieved through those rights. In Malawi, for instance, right now Oxfam supports local organisations, some of which are directly supporting people with HIV/AIDS, but we're also supporting local organisations who are tracking the government's budget. Their fundamental purpose is to track the government's budget and make sure the money in the national accounts are used for the health and education of their citizens. And when they find the clinics without medicines, when they go to the rural schools without the books, they make a national scandal of it. That kind of action allows governments to be essentially accountable for their own economic performance and also for them to eschew corruption. Look too at the power of the press. Fundamental, as Amartya Sen has said, there are no democracies where famines happen. If you take the case in the early 80s when food was short in Sudan, Ethiopia and Botswana, it was no coincidence that Ethiopia and Sudan fell into famine and yet Botswana did not, because it had a functioning democracy and because it had a civil society and a media that was able to call that government to account. 20 years later, it's no surprise either that Botswana was the first place to introduce antiretroviral medicines to all people who are HIV positive in that nation. Democracy and civil society keep governments on their toes and push them to deliver better livelihoods for their people, not just benefits for the elites of their country. And that is why respecting civil and political rights is the best bet for achieving economic development. Now, what of economic, social and cultural rights? Now, cynics, of course, say economic, social and cultural rights. I beg your pardon, they're just needs, they're not rights. These are needs that can be met as soon as the economy gets going. I heard some of that over the other side of the table. Not so. These are rights which governments must strive to fulfil. And no economy can get very far without them. After all, what does it take to get an economy going? It takes a competitive and skilled labour force. But without meeting people's needs for basic health, education and food, no country can create that competitive workforce. It takes domestic demand. But without ensuring that workers are paid decent wages, then essentially no one can afford to buy what's on offer. We've all seen, and I personally have experienced, the misery created of enclave economies, that living, as I did, 2 years in Honduras and seeing the way in which those banana plantations brought economic growth or economic revenue to the country, and yet no real development. The case would be true of Angola with oil at the moment. And it also takes an efficient use of the resources. But any country, for instance, who fails to recognise and promote the rights of women in their country is essentially neglecting and abandoning 50% of the productive potential of their country. The beauty of rights is that they promote economic development, and the beauty of economic development is that they reinforce people's rights. It's not the horse or the cart, it's both at the same time, which is essential. Now, our planet, and particularly the next generation of leaders, of whom I expect quite a number are in this room at the moment, face critical choices in coming years. Nelson Mandela, at the beginning of this year, stood in Trafalgar Square, not very far from this, and said, essentially, that the obscene inequality and the massive poverty that haunts our planet at present are the moral equivalents of slavery and of the apartheid state of the past century. He said that in the face of these challenges, it falls upon a generation to be great. It falls upon that generation to be great because we have the technology and the wealth to eliminate the absolute poverty on this planet. And just as slavery and the anti-slavery movement and the anti-apartheid movement were driven by a model and a rights-based agenda, we will need that rights-based agenda to be front and centre of the movements that must be built to defeat that obscene inequality and that massive poverty in the world. I move this motion because the alternative is a glowering planet of inequality, division and insecurity.
Thanks very much, Phil. And our final speaker from the panel is Professor Suji Yao, who's Chair of Economics at Middlesex University and is the author of many books, including Globalization, Competition and Growth in China, available from all good bookshops and on Amazon.com. Professor.
Okay, thank you very much, Chairman. You just have a vote in here in the audience. 90% of you actually support the motion. Human right is the necessary condition, and it's also the important factors for economic development. Now, I am coming to this position to say the opposite, and I think it will be difficult to follow the minority. But what I'm trying not to be confused is to raise a couple of questions first. The first question is that if you think that human right is important and is the precondition for economic development, then every country in the globe, you can just give people the maximum human right, and then you will expect the economy is going to grow, like the United States, like the United Kingdoms. But the reality is not. The reality is that if you give the maximum human right to every country, every state, without paying special attention to their special circumstances, like the social, economic, and political conditions, then you will be fairly mistaken. The second question is that the definition of human right is always fairly confused by different people. Politicians, like our ambassador, he will try to promote a huge human right in Ghana, and some other government official will come here and say they will have human rights, like Mrs. Thatcher, he will say she gave human rights to the British people while he was trying to abandon the trade union in the United Kingdom in the early 1980s. So my argument is here. Now, number one, the definition of human rights need to be clear. And number two, whether there is a strong causality between human rights and economic development. The question is not easy to answer, but I try to give a few key points here that we need to be aware and we have to be consensus. The first point is that different cultures have different perspectives of human rights. And what regarded as a necessary element of human rights in one culture or in one country is not necessarily important element in another culture or another country. For instance, when we talk about human rights, there are three different categories of human rights, in my view. The first category is the basic need, food, sheltering, clothing, and traveling. This is the very, very basic right. And if a country is not able to fulfill this very basic right, then it would be impossible to implement the next stage of need. And what is the next stage, the next category of needs? The special social and cultural need. For instance, free education, free health care, we call them positive rights or whatever. Yeah. If the country is very poor, how can you have free education? How can you have free medical care? It's impossible. And then on top of that, there's another category of need and right. Then it would be a certain stage of special need. For example, like homosexual, like this sense of capital punishment, free of capital punishment. In a country where if you don't have a forceful capital punishment, lots of people will become rebel, will become criminals on the street, and they will become uncontrollable. Now, in the UK, you can free people from capital punishment. Some people actually committed crime, which is so serious. They rape 20 women and they put in the jail. After 10 years, they come out and get protected for £10,000 per month just to protect their life. But if in a country where the country is very poor and the people are more subject to these kinds of criminal activities, if you don't impose capital punishment, then you will be in serious trouble. The society will be extremely unstable. So what I'm saying here is that some special right may be universal for every country, every culture, like the basic need. But some right may not be necessary for some country. And if you try to artificially impose the right in the most advanced country, the most liberal country, to some other country, you create more instability. You create less economic development rather than promote economic development. So this is my first point. The second point is that if you look at the same country, the same culture, there are different stages of economic development which would have different value and different understanding, interpretation of human right. In other words, human right is a dynamic. It is not a static concept. A dynamic concept, it means that human right in this stage, you interpret with this definition. And as the economy grows, as the society progress, then you may have another definition of human right. Basically, human right is this very artificial definition. People are actually pushing for it, asking for it more and more. Just to give you one very simple example. In the 100 years ago, if you talk about homosexual in this country, how can you talk about right? People would put in prison or people would be isolated. But nowadays, people are asking for equal right, homosexual or heterosexual, heterosexual. Okay? So it is a dynamic process. If you try, at the moment you try to ban homosexual, then you actually don't respect human right. But 100 years ago, if you ban the right, then you are still regarding have human right. So the same culture, the meaning and the demand for human right can also be changing. So this is my second argument. My third argument is that in some country, human right may not be well respected. I say human right is because in some country they try to impose their ethical values, their definition of human right in one society on another society. Okay? And suppose we try to impose some human right from one society to another society, then I would argue the otherwise. It means that in some country, actually the human right, according to the popular definition, may not be well respected. But this does not mean that economic development cannot be promoted. In some country, actually, it is necessary to control some element of human rights in order to promote economic growth. My first point is that in some countries, human rights is well respected, but economy development may not be well respected. For example, if you regard human rights as voting rights, as multi-party system, I can give you some examples, some comparison. In India, you have multi-party election, you have free voting. India is regarded as the most popular democratic country, and China is regarded as the most popular dictatorship country. But which country is doing better? you don't need my calculation, do you? And the last one, in some other extreme cases, I say the extreme cases, at some certain stage, the government need to have a strong hand. It does need to control, to plan, and also in some sense, you need to have dictatorship in order to mobilize the limited resources available to you. Capital and labor mobility is very important for some special policy. If you don't have this strong hand, you cannot mobilize your limited resources to have vast economic growth. So that's my point here. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Professor. In a moment, we're going to come to you in the audience and say, please polish and sharpen your questions. We've got microphones downstairs and upstairs, and I'll be glad to fit in as many questions as I can. I just want to see if anyone from this side just wants to come back on that very punchy and blunt point that the professor made, that if you look at China, it is doing a lot better than India economically. In fact, all over East Asia, authoritarian countries have done rather well under periods of authoritarianism. And doesn't that show that at least you can, and I think you wouldn't say that places like Taiwan and Singapore, Malaysia and so on weren't economically developed. So isn't that quite a strong argument from the other side? You just want to come back briefly on that?
Well, I just say that on the contrary, what those countries did was, and I think the professor hit on it when he said that there were basic needs which are recognized as rights. Those countries had as a platform heavy investments in education, in social infrastructure, all the rights which we are talking about under the International Covenant for Social, Economic, and Cultural Rights. All these rights were recognized by these other countries. So they had a platform on which to build. It is only the political rights which were not recognized, but only for a few in those countries. So clearly the fact that these other rights were recognized showed that they also understood that these rights existed and that these rights could actually form the basis for economic development.
I'm sure we'll come back to that in a moment. Right, we have first couple of questions. The lady down there in the second row got her hand
yes,
up very quickly. Answer that, the lady down there, and then we'll take at the very front here, we've got some rows up in the balcony, the lady in the pink, and then some next to her. Go ahead.
Yes, in fact, I agree with what Alex say. I disagree with Professor Yeo say. You said the economic development in China is growth is up. Yes, because the rulers, they are selling, they are all government owned, most of them. And then they are selling goods at lower than its cost. Of course, they got the highest export because merchants, they are very practical. In that,
very good. Okay, we're going to have very short. The shorter the questions, the more democratic.
Yeah, the question is
the more people get in.
How you say China is doing much better than India because China is a sort of dictatorship when the money all goes to the rulers?
Very good question.
Because they export a lot, they got the money. It goes to the rulers'
pocket your point.
instead of the people.
Very good. Thank you very much. I'm going to take a bunch of questions, then go to the panel. Lady down here in the black. Go ahead, madam.
Okay, thank you very much. We're talking about economic development. It's one part of the thing, and it's related to societies and countries. The examples are all based in India, China, Brazil, and countries. When we talk about human rights, we're talking about freedoms and inequality. What I didn't hear from the speakers was equality in the world. not only inside the countries, because we do have developing countries who abide to international treaties, who respect those rules, who have a standing invitation for rapporteurs on the United Nations human rights system, but then the people, even if they are, if they get education, even when they get degrees, they don't get jobs. This is because the economy of those countries being constrained by IMF obligations, by subsidies in Europe.
So what's your question is?
So I want somebody here to address the question of the basic inequality that we have in the world, not inside the countries, but in the world, and this is actually preventing both human rights and economic development in those developing countries.
Right. And at the risk of sounding good as me, authoritarian, I'm going to say I really do want to try and keep questions pretty. This is a very wide motion. We can very easily get off into very general questions about globalization, good or bad, inequality in the world, and what we do about it. I want to try and. I think every question's got to have the words economic development and human rights in it to be really get a really get an answer. And now the lady up there, and then after that the gentleman there with his hand up in the white shirt. Go ahead, madam.
Human rights is usually taken as a matter between the government and its population, but it related to the last question, in situations where a government can affect the rights of people in other countries, thinking particularly of trade negotiations and the economic, social and cultural rights of people in other countries, it does raise the issue, surely, of the extraterritoriality of human rights obligations, because it seems very silly if it only applies to the government's own population and that they can do what they like to the people in the rest of the world.
Right, OK. Just take the gentleman up there and then we're going to come to the panel. Go ahead, sir. Oh, you're one of the stewards. I'm sorry, I can't see to the... You're very welcome to ask a question, but sorry, I thought you had your hand up. Give it to the gentleman there in the blue shirt, then. So it's a very bright light up there, and I was...
Thanks. Just a quick one on the from the India and China point. I'd just like to ask each of the panellists where you would rather live, given the choice between possibly, if we take what you said to be true, greater economic development and less human rights in China.
Okay, very good. Okay, I'm going to take a quick round from here. Everybody on the panel has to answer the question, does the comparison between India and China strengthen your case or weaken it? That's the question. I'm slightly pulling it together. Go ahead, Phil.
I think in terms of where I'd want to live, I'd want to live anywhere of those two countries if I was in the elites of those countries, which it would probably not be the case because it's not the case for the majority of the people in either of those countries. Does the case of China or India strengthen our case? Certainly. First of all, there have been massive achievements by China, by countries such as Vietnam that have suppressed civil and economic rights, and those have to be... Those have to be recognised. But they have really promoted the social and economic rights of their people, at least in certain phases. Right now in China, that's not the case. And in fact, it's very interesting that this week the Chinese Communist Party is debating precisely the issue of inequality and how much it's undermining right. both economic development as well as human rights. The question we should be asking is, if China and Vietnam had followed a more a path of respecting people's civil and political rights, would they be even better off than they are now? And I think the fundamental answer to that is yes.
Very good. Alex, does China and India comparison strengthen your case or weaken it?
I think it strengthens it. It shows that the economic development is the thing that's really key. No, I'm in favour of human rights. I want Chinese people to have democracy, and I want them to have free speech and to be able to do whatever they like. But it's the question of whether you should try and hinder the economic development in order to get the human rights first. And I don't think that's the answer.
Very good. Your Excellency, would you be better off if Ghana was run by the Chinese Communist Party? or by the Indian government?
I think I'll prefer Ghana to be run by Ghanaians. But I must say that even in China, there has been a recognition of the importance of education, of the importance of providing social infrastructure, of the importance of providing access to health. I know there's been a denial of political and civil rights in China. Certainly, I would prefer to live in a country where I have a voice, and that I have a voice in determining what goes into the process of development. I think this is the way I would prefer to answer the question.
Professor, you've already made the point, which I've been bouncing around. Was there anything in the end of the... Do you think that human rights have any extraterritorial character at all, just to answer the lady up there? Do you think it's every country makes up its own human rights, or is there any kind of universal value?
Yeah, I think they, probably the audience or some people who asked the question may actually misunderstood my exact position. My exact position is actually I'm fully pro-China. I'm fully pro the Chinese communist. In a sense, why I say that is because the people try to impose the human rights definition on China. This is the problem. There's a lady just asked that all the economic growth actually went into the rulers, but actually the general Chinese benefited a lot. You know, the poverty reduction have declined significantly, and there's a middle class who is emerging. What I'm trying to say is that in different economic development stage, there is a different definition, different requirement for human rights. And probably what China is doing now is probably just right for the at this stage.
Yeah? Okay, very good. Thank you very much. We've got a lot of... If people can try and catch my eye during the intervention to the panel, then I'll be able to send the microphone in their direction. Lady down there in the red scarf.
Hello. I had a question on... In the title, it says, respect for human rights is essential to economic development. I was wondering, how would you define who has to respect human rights? Is it state... who is responsible for guaranteeing the human rights? What about foreign direct investment? Is that bound to human rights as well in economic development? And I kind of had another question, which is correlated to that.
You're pushing your luck.
Sorry. which is if you sort of define human development as sort of this large Amartya Sen version, are there priorities? Is economic, social, political rights, like, what's the priority in all of that? Thank you.
Very good. Who should respect it and what priority? And then there was... who's got the microphone? Yes, the gentleman there. Go ahead, sir. And so can I just say, if people don't feel it infringes their human rights for privacy too much, could you say where you're from, like student at the school, come from wherever and so on? It might inform our understanding of your contribution. Go ahead.
Okay, I should start there from introducing myself. So far, everyone has acknowledged.
Okay. Yes. Great. And you can ask a question as well.
My question is related to what she said earlier, foreign investment in order to promote human rights and obviously economic development. I would like the panel to really answer the question whether foreign investment promotes human rights or hinders it. Some developing countries, such as my country, the Ivory Coast, the trouble there, honestly, is related to unfairness and injustice undergone by population, and which so far has prevented them from expressing themselves. And different thinking of current leaders in the country also is seen as against investment, foreign investment interest in those countries, and they have troubles to raise the country's standard.
So you're saying that foreign the ability to attract foreign investment is a kind of human right?
No, I'm not saying that. The foreign investment in the country
is propping it up. It's propping up the bad rulers. Is that?
No, not propping up the bad rulers, but is fighting good governance.
Right.
To promote economic development and economic, social, and cultural rights of the country.
Excellent.
And even political and civil rights of the countries.
Very good. Okay, understood. Let's take two questions to the balcony as well, because we're very fair-minded here. Who's got the mic? Yes, you go ahead, sir.
Hi, my name is Li Shai, MSc International Relations here at LSE. I have a question about why, basically, I'd like to hear a clear explanation why economic development has to precede human rights. Why can't they come at the same time? And why can we hold those governments accountable for developing human rights at the same time as economic development? I have a five-year-old friend whose father was tortured to death in China because of his religious belief. Why is she going to have to grow up not knowing her father because he had to wait for human rights? why is another friend of mine who has a fiancé being tortured in China right now?
Right,
the way to economic development. Now, I'm assuming that Mr. Yao is going to continue to give us the party line, but I'm really interested in.
Well, let's try and keep abuse out of it, and I think that would be good manners apart from anything else. My question
is specifically, why do we need to wait for economic development? Okay. For people to be able to express their views or religious belief and so on.
Very good. I'll take one more question up there. Mm-hmm. Yes, go ahead.
Good evening. I'm student at LSE. How do you account for the United Kingdom's economic development that came about in an era of imperial oppression? Now, this country is now one of the greatest fighters for human rights today.
That sounds a bit like China. It's the same question. I think we've sort of asked that question using China as an example. We could perfectly well ask it about Imperial Britain. I think I'm going to take a quick round on this question of the foreign investors. Alex, do you think foreign investors are under any obligation at all to respect human rights, or is their sole duty to go in and make money?
Well, I think it's a more fluid thing than that. I think what happens is when a multinational company goes into a developing country, there's a lot of pressure on that company to do the right thing. I think the abuse Nike got over so-called sweatshop labor in the 90s pressurized that company to be very careful about the labor standards and its dealings in that country. So I think there's with foreign direct investment, you get foreign press. You get lots of LSE students who go around boycotting their products and writing to the shareholders and that sort of thing. So I think there is some pressure.
But you're against that?
Not entirely.
But you can't say on the one hand FDI is subject to pressure because the consumers will boycott, on the other hand say, but I'm against economic sanctions. Is sanctions all right when they're done by LSE students but not by governments?
Well, I think the argument that Nike should withdraw from certain countries would be very damaging because it would take jobs away and so forth. But the argument that Nike should respect its workers seems to me, some pressure seems to me a beneficial thing. I think the arguments, there was an interesting question here about whether, isn't it wrong that people should be, people are being killed in China, and shouldn't we therefore put pressure on, shouldn't we do something about this? And it seems to me that if you want to have those human rights, the best thing you can do is to help promote the trade and investment. If you really want to do something about human rights abuses, you could go and be terribly imperialistic and invade the country and force them to recognize human rights. But I don't think that would be a good option. And so in a world of imperfect options about putting pressure on other countries, I think let's have the trade, let's have the investments, and that's the best way of putting forward the human rights.
Very good. Professor, do you want to respond to the criticism made up there? Why should the victims of what we call, or the West calls, human rights abuses in China have to wait? Why can't they? Why can't human rights go hand in hand with economic development?
Right. I just want to give an example. When Mrs. Thatcher tried to suppress the trade union in the UK, and if suppose that Mrs. Thatcher didn't do that, what would be the economy situation in the UK in the early 1980s? And the other thing that I don't quite believe that the kinds of cases that you are talking about is actually a very popular case in China, because I observe a lot of things. I didn't see evidence of such unfair killing. And I think you pinch an image which actually surprised me quite a lot. There are cases, if people who, committed crime and they should be punished, and there's a capital punishment in China, there's no point of avoiding that. Because what I'm saying is that if you try to abolish capital punishment for some people, there will be so many criminals that would jeopardize the stability of the country, that would in turn would jeopardize economic development. Mm. So if the people who are doing something fundamentally wrong, according to the law and regulation, then they should be punished.
Very good.
Well, it depends on the cases where how much crime they commit, and I don't know how much crime.
I suspect we're going to get more questions on this, but I'm going to go to your Excellency. You wanted to say something about the extraterritoriality. How would you feel if someone came along to Ghana and said, "Well, you're not obeying human rights properly, and you've got to do this or that or the other"?
Well, I think we already have that in the African peer review mechanism.
Yeah.
where all the African countries under NEPAD have agreed that they will be peer-reviewed, you know, by other countries. So in Ghana, we opened up our doors, you know, the basic criteria, you know, for assessing this, and we allowed, you know, the peer reviewers to come into our country from other countries. We also have our own internal peer review system to ensure that the government actually keeps to the various covenants that we have signed. So there's some amount of extraterritoriality, you know, in the respect for human rights. Also, in any case, all these conventions, the covenants that I mentioned earlier, are international conventions. So each has to be, you know, all of us have to be keepers in this matter. I just want to make a comment about something which was said by Alex earlier concerning Ghana, you know, and related to the FDIs. You said that I talked about 1992 as the watershed, but it was really 1983. And this was to bolster your argument that even in a dictatorial regime, you could have progress which leads to democracy. But I beg to differ. 1983 was the period when we started an economic recovery program with World Bank and IMF support. But we know that the huge infusions of cash made by these multilateral agencies only went to bolster the Rawlings regime at that time and kept it in power to the detriment of the people. And they performed so well that in 2000 we had to declare our country as a highly indebted poor country. That was the end result. We became a highly indebted poor country because we borrowed monies which we did not invest properly in our country. So that is why I say 1992 was the period, because we had democracy, there was accountability in our country.
And Phil, I'm paraphrasing Friedrich von Hayek here, but he said that there was only one thing worse than being an exploited worker in the third world, and that was being an unexploited worker in the third world. If the you put pressure on people for not for foreign investors for not upholding human rights or for propping up corrupt regimes, and then that leads to people being jobless. What's the moral calculus there? How bad does someone have to be before it's better? Does a regime have to be before it's better for people to be poor than even poorer?
Well, we would say that calculus is a false one. If what we want in a country such as China, where there are substantial suppression of workers' rights, is simply the rights of workers to organise freely, to be in a negotiation, a collective negotiation, with the foreign direct investment, with the domestic capital of that country, to get a fair share of what is theirs in terms of the national wealth. That's the calculus that we have to make. And from our perspective, you know, foreign direct investment has a fundamental role in terms of promoting human rights. But unfortunately, the World Trade Organization, for instance, through the investment agreement, has removed all the performance indicators that were necessary for developing countries to do the same as what every industrialized country has done, which is to make sure foreign direct investment actually serves the development interests of that country. And so we've got things way out of kilter, and that's one of the issues around extraterritoriality. But I want to just come to one other thing, and that's the issue of the transparency issue as well of foreign direct investment. If you take the situation in Angola, you've got massive investment by oil companies. They are paying enormous revenues to the MPLA, to the national government of Angola, and yet that country is in absolute despair and misery for the great majority of that people. The MPLA elite are doing extremely well for themselves. The issue is we need transparency about what monies are being paid into the national accounts in order for people to be able to organise freely and demand what is their fair share of that of those royalties from the national natural resources that are being exploited.
So, but you are saying that if trade unions are illegal and you can't have workers organising as you would like, then it should be absolutely verboten, out of the question, that anybody should invest in that country. That seems to be what you're saying.
No, what we are saying is that it's a fundamental issue for any foreign direct investor to go in to be constantly asking, when are we going to be able to allow trade unions to be formed? Because this is impeding both our economic performance as well as the economic performance of this country.
So a foreign investor should go to China and say to the Chinese government, please can I have trade unions? They say no, and then they carry on investing. And then you'd be happy.
The point from our perspective is a slightly less flippant one, which is that the workers in China and in any other country where those workers' rights are suppressed The workers need every bit of support they can get in terms of being able to achieve what is theirs. What they don't need are the kind of boycotts that actually destroy their the livelihood, so they're all thrown out of work. And we have worked very hard, putting massive pressure on some of those investors, such as the sportswear companies, saying that they've got to start respecting workers' rights in those countries, but at the same time saying to people, don't start boycotting, because that's the worst thing, because we're going to throw more people into misery.
So, Alex, do I detect a measure of agreement between you and Oxfam, or can we try and get...
Well, you know, I've always taken the view that Oxfam is one of the better NGOs.
Don't patronise. They may think you're one of the better think tanks, I don't know.
You know, they're not poor on wants in the World Development Movement. I think I would agree pretty much with that, although I'm not sure that there are many businesses that really want trade unions.
Right, okay. Good, let's get some more questions in. And who's got the microphone? Yes, gentleman at the back. Go ahead, sir.
I'm an LSE student from the US, and I was interested in Mr. Bloomer's distinction between economic growth and economic development. And so I was hoping to hear a response to this idea that respect for human rights and democracy will also tend to democratize economic benefits and thus push development forward. So.
Professor, you're by far the most distinguished economist on the panel. Is there any meaningful distinction between economic growth and economic development?
Yes, economic growth is probably in a short-term dynamic, and economic development is probably in a long-term stage. So without growth, you don't have development, but development is the ultimate goal. Probably that's my definition. You may not agree with that.
Do you agree with the answer you just received? He says he didn't really understand it. Well, take the mic, please. Just
yeah, I can't hear you actually. Yeah.
Does respect for human rights and democracy also democratize economic benefits?
Slightly different question, but
it's a different question. Then.
Yeah, very good. Okay, now the gentleman there, who's been exceptionally patient.
Yeah, okay. My name is Bram. I'm from SOAS, around the corner. Yesterday, at the same time, we were sitting in this auditorium listening to Yung Chang, who was talking about her biography on Mao. She was detailing into great detail how, during Mao's rule, 70 million people died in China. To which a gentleman all the way in the front on the right, who I strongly suspect to have been from the Chinese embassy, kept stressing how much growth there was in China during that same period, to which Yung Chang kept saying that there were 70 million people who died. Now, 25 years later, which is 2 years ago, approximately...
Sorry, very briefly, because we've
got... Yeah, okay, very briefly. My question is, economic development can take place without human rights, but to what cost? I still haven't heard from the two gentlemen on the right. 70 million people is... I mean, what else? Right?
What price did you build? I always understood that China went backwards.
That's what Yung Chang was saying, but then the gentleman from the Chinese embassy was saying...
When I was at LSE, there were Maoist parties here who thought that China had been doing absolutely fine until under the Gang of Four, and everything had gone wrong under mm-hmm. Deng. So it may have been from that. Now, I should say at this point, there's no way I'm going to get all the questions in, so please forgive me, but do save up your energy if you don't get called, and contribute to the discussion, which we're going to have at an undisclosed location, which is, I may say, upstairs from here. You've only got another 20 minutes to go. Right, the lady over there has got the microphone. Go ahead, man.
My name is Minghua Zhao, and I'm a Chinese from China, and I was here on Monday. Monday and today, I heard people mentioning a lot of China. I feel, given the capacity I have as the director of China Labor Studies Center, I feel I'm obliged to say something.
Yes, briefly, and a question.
Well, can I make a very brief statement? And particularly with regards to Professor Yao's, what sounds to me quite scary, argument. And given the empirical data we have collected in China, we talked to, the data includes our interviews with the management at various levels, but also workers on shop floor in various industries, we find people, workers in particular, are not really happy just to have enough food to eat
and not hungry to have a roof over their head. They are scared without rights, fundamental rights to speech, freedom of speech, and freedom of association. They are at the risk of losing their roof, of losing their food, and so on. And second part of my statement is I also have another capacity.
I think perhaps.
No,
I think, sorry, I'm going to cut you off there because it's just so unfair. There's about 25 other hands, and if we have everybody asking two questions, I understand you conduct research, and that's wonderful, but I'm afraid you've had your chance. I'm going to give Professor a very brief chance just to reply to those two points that were made specifically to you, and I think after that I'm going to try and encourage people to get back to the general motion and keep off the case of China. And I'll get the microphones can go to the lady there with the blue, who's been very patient, and the lady here at the front has been very patient. Go ahead, Professor. Yeah.
I think I'm put in a fairly difficult situation here, because it's always not easy to give you the accurate expression of what I actually want to say. Now, what I want to say is that you have to look at the human right in a dynamic process, and you don't look at human right from a country's perspective, forced on China. That would be a danger in my view. For example, the human right in China is different from the human right in the United States. And if you try to impose the standard of human right in the United States on China, then you are doing something fairly, fairly wrong. The basic thing is that including FDI or the kinds of people feeling about the security and so on and so forth, is that China in 1978, there were huge number of people who are living in absolute poverty. And the kinds of progress I think the basic change of human rights is the massive number of people who are lifted out from poverty. And that's the tremendous progress. In order to do this, some element of Western human rights have to be forgot. At least in the short term. But in the longer term, when people have enough food to eat, when people get better, they will require more.
Very good. Okay. Now, the lady in the front here, and the lady in blue first, and then the lady in the front here.
Yeah. Queen Mary, student from Morocco. My question is simple. Alex said that basically the horse comes before the car, right? Fair enough. And Oxfam said that basically, he believes that both of them can be at the same time, the economic, the human rights, and the economic development. I mean, in ideal world, I hope it's the right. But I'm just asking him, can he please just give me one example, one country which actually flowing the two of them at the same time, at one country that have actually respect its human rights, and at the same time having economic development, because we know that the economic development comes before human rights. Once the economy is developed, they start like fighting for the human rights.
Okay.
I'm just asking for very one example.
Okay. Just a very quick direct answer. Can you name a country which has scored top marks on human rights and done developed very developed very fast? Exhibit A?
I think Ghana.
Very good. Well, I'm just going to take we've got about 4 or 5 minutes left before we go into the final, the very final round from the speakers. So I'm just going to, who has been? It's very difficult choices. The gentleman there in the black jacket has had his hand up for a very long time in the third row from the back. So we get a microphone to him, and then you've got the microphone already. Why don't you go ahead now?
Hi. Good evening. My name's Emma Taylor. I'm on the MSc Human Rights here at LSE. I just have a question to put to the opposition, and if you could please reconcile for me two things I've heard from your side this evening. Professor Yao, you mentioned that if many of the prisoners in China were not to be killed, and in fact if you were to release many of the prisoners in China, some of whom I believe may be unfairly detained, this is actually going to potentially jeopardize the economy of China. I find that very interesting, given that Mr. Alex Singleton has used this analogy that was also just touched on of the horse before the cart. And in what way, given that if the horse of the economy is pulling the cart of the human rights, is the horse really pulling that cart, or has the horse run off without the cart.
Well, okay, that's a fascinating extension of the metaphor, which are which we will come back to in the closing remarks. Yes, and then the gentleman in the middle there, go ahead.
Hi, I'm a student from LC, and my question is not about China, it's about India and China.
Yes.
I think there's a lot of people now discussing about economic development in both countries. But my question is, if you go to China now, you will find the most famous people in China are economists. But at the moment, well, they are not as famous as those from India. But my question is, why do we have an economist from India who could see economic development as more choices being provided, and by the way, who also won the Nobel Prize, yes, while most economists in China still regard GDP growth as the only focus, although China has already enjoyed a higher GDP growth than India? Thank you.
Why is there no Chinese Amartya Sen? I'm not sure that's... It's very, very hard to answer these kind of abstract questions. The gentleman up there has been very patient. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, Larry Wally, resident. My point is that I'm not happy with the comments made by the gentleman on the right.
So can you speak really directly into the microphone, because your words are being lost on the people down here.
All right. My comment is about the chap on the right who said Africa has swallowed about 5 times the FDI given to Europe in the Marshall Plan. What he's not pointing out is that most of that money actually ends up in Europe, so it is not actually invested in Africa. There's no residue in Africa. And the second thing is, I think the panel needs to stress even more importantly the global perspective on human rights, because if Europe sponsors Shell to exploit and destroy parts of Africa, are you really promoting human rights for the world or just for yourselves?
Thank you. Slightly rhetorical question, but obviously a popular one. Yes, go ahead, sir.
Yes, my name is Salah. I'm from Egypt, and I'm an MSc student studying political sociology. The question that I'd like to raise is that usually dictatorships teaches the public speakers very well, and when they want to diffuse an issue as important as human rights, they look for a definition. Human rights are clearly defined, and everyone knows that every human being has a right to be happy and has a right to avoid suffering. Okay, and human rights can follow from that statement. The second point, development first, democracy later, or development first, development first, human rights later. I think what the panel didn't touch on, and I think this might answer the question why China is doing so well, is that you're only measuring economic development. Economic development is part of sustainable, complete development, social, political,
okay,
and so on. So I guess, does China rank well when it comes to sustainability?
Very good. Now, I just want to say, just to be fair, there's a whole forest of questions, and I can't possibly take them, and it seems unfair to be completely random. But I just want, is there anybody in the audience who has actually had first-hand experience of human rights abuses, i.e. been a political prisoner, or been perhaps married to a political prisoner, or the son and daughter of a political prisoner, or a parent of a political prisoner, or some other sort of connection like that? Because if so, I'd quite like to... Yes, if that applies to you, madam, I'd be glad.
I lived in Palestine in the last 3 years, so I've witnessed a lot of human rights abuses committed by Israel. Thank you.
Well, I think that was an ingenious shot, if a rather cheap one. Okay, I've got time for one more question. The gentleman at the very, very end there in the red sweatshirt had his hand up almost from the beginning, so I'm going to give the final word to him, then we're going to go to the panel.
Yeah, my name is Suleiman, and I come from Ethiopia, and my uncle was arrested because he wrote a book against the current government in Ethiopia, and basically clashed with their objectives during the election. So he was arrested. Now, can I ask my question?
That's absolutely right. You've earned your question. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask, like, Professor Yao, on without human rights, economic development is difficult because of the instability there will be within a country. And this instability, this human rights could not be implied because of the cultural background of the society, meaning it could be hard to imply it. And so every developed country has gone through different routes to reach where they are right now. Do you think these developing countries at the moment should go through that routine that these ones have done, because it will take less time because of the technological advancement?
Right. Okay. Very, very fair question. Well, we're now going to go into our final. I'm afraid I've simply got, because I don't want to detain you after 8 o'clock. So some people may have things they want to do, and it's we always try and end on time. So we're going to go into our final round, where I'm going to ask each member of the panel just to respond briefly and try and encapsulate their point in the most combative and enlightening way that they can. While that's happening, if you could, those of you who've got feedback forms, would like to fill them in, because that enables us to tailor our debates programme as closely as possible to your wishes and interests. So I'm going to go in the following order. I'm going to ask His Excellency the High Commissioner of Ghana.
Was it
the other way around? Okay, right. We're going to go in reverse order. I'm sorry, I was losing track. So Professor Yao, you've got 2 minutes to wrap up your case and try and increase the share of the vote from a tenth to perhaps a 20th or even a quarter or a third.
Yeah. Okay, I think my position is very clear. I would say that it is in different cultures, different stages, the understanding and the tolerance, acceptance of human rights and economic development is very different. And for some special countries, some special stages, they have to adopt a certain standard of human rights. This kind of standard of human rights may not be the best standard in the world, but they are the most suitable for the stage of the economic development. This is my first statement. The second statement is that economic development itself can actually drive the promotion of human rights. So once people become better off, they would require more change, more reform for the government to improve the level of human rights.
Thank you very much. Phil.
Thank you. If you oppose this motion, you're voting into the hands essentially of global elites and authoritarian governments around the world who want to be able to justify their power and privilege and the retention of that power and privilege. They want you to support them to keep the mass of the people without a political voice and without a basic standard of living and the opportunity to better themselves. Poverty is man-made, and human rights is one of the fundamental ways by which we can end poverty, and the end of poverty is one of the fundamental ways by which we can achieve human rights. If you support this motion, you're voting for a world whose strategy for the future is essentially to build on the fundamental values of human life. You're voting for a difficult and long struggle for human progress. But you're voting also for a virtuous circle between economic development and human rights. You're voting essentially for what Nelson Mandela talked about, for the end of that obscene inequality and the end of that massive poverty. I ask you to vote for the motion.
Right, thanks very much, Phil. Alex, you might want to argue that wealth is man-made and poverty is actually natural, but I'll leave it to you to...
Well, yeah, poverty is the natural state of things. It's what most people, for the entirety of human history, have lived under. It's something that only in the last two or three centuries we've really seen a change to. But I'm an optimist, and the fact is that in China, in the last 10 or 20 years, 200 million Chinese people have been lifted out of poverty for the first time. There are still 160 million people living on under a dollar a day, but 200 million so far have been lifted out of poverty. And the fact is that in the next 20 years, we're going to get those 160 million out of poverty. We're going to have a middle class in China. We're going to see human rights and prosperity in a middle class in that country. And so we're going to have that on the back of the economic development. So let's not sort of think that we should stop the economic development if we can't get the human rights. Let's not have sanctions against China or try and impose, force them, stop them joining the WTO a few years back. That would have been a completely wrong policy. I think it's great what's happening in China. I'm an optimist as to what it will be in the future. And that's why I beg you to vote against this motion.
Thanks very much, Alex. It really is your turn now. Sorry.
Well, I reject any argument which says that there are different sorts of human rights for some people at a certain point in history, you know, as has been argued on the other side. I reject that totally. Indeed, our position is that the ultimate purpose and focus of economic development is to assure people a better life in which civil and political rights, as well as social, economic, and cultural rights, are respected. Giving voice to people is probably the most effective way of fostering consciousness of the possibility of improving efficiency, equity, and well-being concurrently. There's no better way of creating a virtuous circle. Mr. Chairman, let me finally say that the right to development itself can indeed be considered a human right, which encompasses the realization of civil, political, social, economic, and cultural rights. I thank you.
Well, thank you very much indeed as well. I'm now, I think, going to, as I've had everybody from the panel, we're going to move on to the final dramatic moment, which is the straw poll. So can I just remind you, we are not voting on do you or do you not like the government of China. Would you rather live in India or China? It's not about what you think about capital punishment, and it's not whether you think human rights are a good thing. The motion, and I'm saying this with some emphasis because I drafted it myself with some thought, and I want you to pay attention to it. The motion is respect for human rights is essential to economic development. So, hands up, those of you who would vote for this motion. Right, and hands up the brave, I suspect, minority who'd vote against it. Well, I detect a slight swing against the motion. I would say you've gone from perhaps a tenth of the audience to 15%. So, in that sense, the motion has been carried, but the losers walk from the battlefield with at least something to be proud of. I'd like to thank all our panelists and also you for your excellent questions. I'd also like, just before, you've got to hang on because you don't know where the drinks are yet. I'd like to flag up the next debate, which is on a slightly similar subject, but a very interesting one and related, at Chatham House. It's on the 18th of October, and it is the motion Latin America has regular elections but lacks citizens' democracies. Please don't forget to hand in your feedback form as you go out, and if you forget to do that, you can always send it back to us on the form provided. And I can now say the drinks are going to be, Connor, on the fifth floor, and those of you who know LSE will know exactly where that is. If not, just follow the crowd. And I'd like you to join me finally in thanking the speakers very much indeed for their performance.